Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 6th, 2006, and our session today is an always audacious authority. Our presenter is Michael Pellett. Session number POM 2006-2. Let's listen in.
Begin, so if you would start burning the CD, please. Good morning and welcome to all of you. This is the second session in this week of six sessions that I'll be doing on Matthew 28, 16 to 20, which is sometimes known as the Great Commission, and it's the section from which our summer's theme is taken. I am with you always. And so what we're doing this week is looking at that Great Commission and that understanding of what Jesus' word about I am with you always means. And yesterday, as way of a very quick overview, we looked at verses 16 and 17 and noted how from Matthew's perspective, first of all, resurrection appearances are very understated. In fact, this is the only appearance of Jesus to the disciples. At the beginning of chapter 28, we had the announcement that Jesus has been risen to the women at the tomb. Jesus appears to those women and gives them the commission, if you will, to go tell the disciples, meet me in Galilee. And now here in verses 16 through 20, Jesus meets the disciples in Galilee. And as we said, comparing it to other resurrection appearances, if you will, there's no splash. There's no coming through locked doors. There's no doubting Thomas story that says, you know, look, jab your hand into my side and gouge my nail wounds or anything. Nothing like that. Very understated appearance. And that, again, I think how this fits for Matthew is that the focus is always on the word, the teaching. In Matthew's gospel, Jesus is the teacher. And as we'll see, one of the key things of the commission here is that now we as disciples continue that teaching ministry. So that what has the presence, what has the focus, is the word. And everything else is understated or eclipsed by Matthew's gospel. Secondly, we looked at the notion of that, again, it is only the 11 disciples, a kind of sense of incompletion and imperfection. We didn't need the 12, and it is in that sense a broken and fragmented community, and yet Jesus takes those 11 and the others that are there, we'll get there, and gives them that commission to go and continue to teach, to make that word known and present. Then we looked at, and that's what's still on the board, mountains. Mountains are very important in Matthew's gospel because mountains are where revelation happens. And that's been the biblical tradition in terms of mountains and revelation have been going on ever since Moses and Mount Sinai. And even here, for those of you last year, with the theme, take off your shoes, to add a little bit more to that, that Moses is out there in Exodus chapter 3, a great play on words. Moses is in exile from Egypt because of that, and he's working for his father-in-law, tending the sheep, and he's out there, min dabar, which means wilderness, but even more than that, it literally, it's on the west side of the wilderness. So it's as wildernessly wilderness as you can get. And then in the burning bush episode, God appears to Moses, and instead of using the word Sinai, they use the word Horeb, Mount Horeb. And Horeb literally means wasteland. So there you are on the west side of the wilderness on Mount Wasteland, and that's where God is, right? In the least imaginable spot, God's presence is there. Now again, for Matthew, that's not quite as radical, but it is the kind of sense you can see that particularly after the crucifixion, the disciples living in that kind of deserted wasteland understanding of what will happen now, having only, if you will, the women's word about that. And we talked about how, again, within the tradition, the testimony and witness of women is totally unreliable, right? You would never trust a woman to tell you anything that would be of any veracity or witness. And so yet, right, they go to the mountain. And in Matthew here, yesterday we went through and listed all the places where mountains are important and how the seventh one, the Great Commission here, picks up a theme for all of these. The first time there was a mountain was the mountain of temptation, third temptation. Satan takes God, or takes Jesus up to the mountain and says, worship me and I'll give you all authority. We see in the Great Commission, and that's the phrase we'll look at today, it is now God who gives Jesus all authority. So that pulls together. Sermon on the Mount is, again, the great teaching sermon. And here in the Great Commission, again, Jesus says, teach all that I have commanded you, all that I taught you. Feeding of the 4,000, the Gentiles, happens on a mountain. So again, a sense of mountain, the all nations. It is not just for Israel, but for the Gentiles. Fourth time, Jesus is on a mountain to pray. Again, that closeness to God. The transfiguration is the mountain, and the important thing that's there is the voice from heaven that says about Jesus, listen to him. And that sense there again here in the Great Commission, who do we listen to? Who do we pay attention to? Jesus and Jesus' words. The sixth time is the Mount of Olives. This is chapters 24 and 25 of Matthew. It's Jesus' teachings about the end of the world. And that's pulled in here in the Great Commission, again, in terms of Jesus' words of assurance, I am with you always. That puts, again, a very interesting twist on how do we understand end of the world. And again, like I said yesterday, given that word of assurance, I am with you always, there is no ascension in Matthew's gospel, because an ascension wouldn't really quite fit with that. If Jesus is with us always, there is no sense of ascension and absence, but there's that notion always of the full presence of God. And so we'll have to talk about that. And kind of the third big theme that we looked at yesterday was that given that Jesus meets them there, there is that kind of simultaneous notion that they worship and doubt. And I note that, again, in Greek, lots of folks want to go through some nice, cute grammatical ways of making that into a partitive so that it's some doubted. But as I said on the board, just a little hoy, it's, you know, no, it's the same crew who worship. They're also the one who doubts. And so we ask that question, are any of you able to worship and doubt at the same time? And you said, yeah, we kind of do that a lot. And so we talked about what that means and what that has to say. So that's a very quick overview of what happened yesterday. Today, I want to look very closely at verse 18, and that sense of authority. Jesus came and said to them, "All authority in heaven and upon earth has been given to me." That's the text I want to look at, and of course, that question of authority. And that certainly in today's session, it will be good to question authority. I'm accepted, of course, in that. I wouldn't want you to question me, but any other authority, feel free.
Preacher Renita.
Let's take that out of the table. Yeah. But that whole sense of authority, because for many of us, I think we look at authority, again, as some sense of coercion, of power over, of dominating, control. And that's not the sense of authority. That's not the understanding that Matthew, and we'll look at how Matthew uses authority throughout his gospel to help us get a notion of what Jesus means here by that authority. But first, before we get there, the beginning of this, and again, very simple words, innocent phrases, but in Matthew are just packed with all sorts of things. The first one is that very innocuous phrase, "and Jesus came," and Jesus came up. And you go, well, you know, whoopee-doo, right? As though that would be something earth-shattering. But it is for Matthew. Pros elthon, the Greek verb there, if you look through your text in terms of how that word is used in Matthew, you will find that in Matthew, it's used 52 times. 50 times people come up to Jesus. Usually they want to be healed or they want something or whatever. There's only two times where Jesus comes up to someone else. And in both instances, it's disciples. Those two times where Jesus comes up to the disciples, the one time is here, the very end of the gospel. The other time is in the Transfiguration story. It's Matthew chapter 17, verse 7. And it's at the very end of the Transfiguration story that Jesus has been transfigured. There is that voice from heaven, and the disciples fall upon their faces because they are deeply frightened. And then Jesus comes up to them. So that I think here in the two times, in the Transfiguration time and in this end of the gospel, when Jesus comes up to them, it's because of the sense of the disciples frightened, terrified in some senses. That again, within the Jewish tradition, the appearance of God, or to be in God's presence, is usually understood as a frightening and terrifying experience. Some of you who might do history of religions or philosophy of religions might have read Rudolf Otto's book, The Idea of the Holy. And what is the notion of the holy? Otto talks about that sense of the holy as mysterium tremendum et fascinans. There you go. See that? That sounds very, very impressive when you say that in Latin, doesn't it? but it means a tremendous, a terrifying, an overwhelming and fascinating mystery. And again, that fascinated, you know, you're kind of overwhelmed if you're truly, I'll do it this way, you know, there are notions of tremors and fascination. That's what happens in the presence of God. There is that sense. Luther commenting on the transfiguration passage, but I think it also applies here about that sense of the disciples. Luther talks about how we understand God, or how God might come to us in two ways. Luther talks about Deus nudus and Deus incarnatus. Deus nude, right? The nude God, the naked God. And Luther always says, beware of the naked God, it'll kill you. It'll terrify you. It will scare you to death. Because in the presence of the naked God, we would recognize truly who we are, and we could not live. But there is also the incarnate God, the infleshed God, God who comes to us in humanity. And he understands that is who Christ is. Jesus, clothed in humanity. That is the God who picks us up. That is the God of mercy and compassion. That is the God who comes up to us. So again, also in kind of classic Lutheran language about this, the Deus nudus is always the God of wrath, of accusation, where we stand in the presence of the Holy One and recognize just how incomplete, imperfect we are. But the incarnate God, that is the God of mercy. That is the God of compassion and of grace who comes to us. And so here again, right, the recognition that in this passage, Matthew never says the word forgiveness, but by the very actions of Jesus in this, by coming up to the disciples, there is the sense of forgiveness. That too, again, earlier in the commission to the women was given away when Jesus refers to those male disciples as brothers. That sense of forgiveness and Jesus coming up to them again, why would there be that sense of forgiveness there? Why, as we read this last section of Matthew, would we want to think about forgiveness?
They all took off.
Yeah. Think about if you had however many disciples, right, your best friends, and they did to you what these 11 did to Jesus. You probably wouldn't be a happy hiker. Forgiveness may not be your first response. Could be something else. Right? Anger, retribution, revenge, criticism, all sorts. So that again, this sense of Jesus coming up to them is already that sense of forgiveness. Is what I would want to argue here, the sense of re-establishing that relationship, the sense again of taking the disciples, calling them and lifting them up from their fears, and again, finally, reassuring them, as we'll see in the end, that he is with them. And so again, it is that sense that Jesus and Jesus' word is what will grasp us, is what will lift us up. Okay. Secondly, then, as we look to this, right, Jesus came up and then again and says to them. Again, very low key. For example, if we look at the way the Sermon on the Mount begins, this is in chapter 5, verse 2. It said that Jesus opened his mouth and was teaching. Right? Far more, if you will, kind of glamorous ways of talking about things. Here it's, he just, you know, said and spoke. As though, again, common, ordinary words. And then what he has to say is all authority. So we begin to talk about this word authority and what it means. And here again, just to help us through, we're going to let Matthew tell us what he means by the authority of Jesus. And I'll put those references up and we'll look at those. And we'll together work through then what is meant by authority. This sense of authority is in chapter 7, verse 29, 8, 9, 9, 6, 10, 1. Over here, very interesting one. We'll have to kind of look at the whole thing on that one, chapter 21, verses 23 to 27. But we'll work through all of these a little bit. Chapter 7, verse 29. Would someone read that for us, please?
For he taught them as one having authority, and not as their scribes.
Okay, and this is the very last verse. This comes at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. So that's chapters 5, 6, and 7. Jesus has been teaching them all along, and now it's with authority, not as that of the scribes. So what does that mean? What kind of sense of authority are we getting here?
To me, what that means is Jesus speaks as the author of it, not as somebody that's writing it down from someone else's telling.
Okay, so that here we're saying that there's the authority because Jesus is the author. Okay, what else?
It's not the kind of authority that comes with just having a title, you know, or an office that, okay, I'm the grand poobah, so therefore you have to respect me.
Not a title or office.
I think too with the scribes and the Pharisees, when you think about the mission, sort of, you know, reading through on the one hand, on the other hand, there is a clarity, perhaps. I'm not sure how to put it.
Well, we'll just write
if
down
you
clarity.
Use that word, that probably is as close as I can.
When I think of rabbis and or scribes and how they taught, they would have referred to other rabbis. And I hear Jesus referring directly to God.
Mm-hmm. Directly to God, or even to himself.
Yes.
And look at is it okay if I write down here self-referential?
Yes, that's good.
But that, right, I mean, that's a very important, because again, if you look at the Sermon on the Mount, and it's the kind of, I'll talk about that a little more, but already, it's always first person pronoun, right? I say to you, a rabbi or a pastor or some, I mean, we would say, as Jesus says in Matthew, right? I'm not sitting here, but I say to you, give me all your money. No, right? Which wouldn't go very far, but it's always worth a try. Yeah, it's right. Jesus is that, it's that self-referential. It's always the I, so you know that he is the authority. Anything else anyone wants to say about this sense of authority?
When I think of someone speaking with authority, I think of just kind of a sense you get when someone is speaking. So more kind of a delivery thing, maybe, I don't know. But just the way that someone speaks, you can just tell that this is authentic, this is real, this is true. You know, they're not going after something.
Without deference.
Yeah, that's a good word, too, that plays off of author. And right. I mean, they all come from that same root, don't they? Author, authentic, authority. Yeah, but that's a good adjective for it as well, that it's authentic. Anything else for this passage?
Just a part of that they embody what they're talking about, so that they're a compelling witness, so that you want to believe what they're saying, as opposed to, again, just that they're saying you should trust me. You want to trust me.
And in that sense, again, it's kind of like saying, and Jesus is the authority. That kind of sense that's there. All right, let's move to chapter 8, verse 9. And just to give you the context of that, this is the healing of the Roman centurion's servant. And if someone would read verse 9 there for us, please.
For I also...
Okay. For I also am a man under authority, with soldiers under me, and I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my slave, do this, and the slave does it.
All right. What sense of authority is there?
That's that office.
Your office notion of authority.
Worldly.
Command. The preposition is under.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Hierarchy.
Hierarchy? Is that what everybody thinks that means? Hierarchy?
Has some sense of coercion.
No.
Coercion. You don't, there's consequence. You don't follow, there's consequences.
Sounds like someone else has declared it, because it's not the top one.
It sounds like the buck doesn't stop there. If there's any blame, he can pass it on.
but I think the way
you're so negative. Let me challenge you about this and say, I think Matthew and Jesus here want this to be a positive sense of authority.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I think, the way he describes it, I say go and he goes and come and he comes. I mean, that's kind of like, God spoke and the world was created.
Yes! Thank you. I just agree with you so much on that one, Paul. Not that it would be the right one. Let me give you a fancy, fancy word for that, for all you people who know rhetoric. This is the perlocutionary force of the word. In other words, saying it is the action. Perlocutionary forces of the word. The one you all know for that is Genesis 1, right? Let there be, and there was, right? That's the kind of authority that perlocutes, right? The centurion commands and it is. Or for all of us in our lives, the perlocutionary force of a word comes in with promise. Easiest example there is the notion of marriage. What's the action of marriage? In the whole ceremony, you've got all that stuff, but it finally boils down to when those two people say, I do. And when they say, I do, it's done, right? In other words, saying I do is the marrying, is the promising to each other, and it is the promising that is the marriage, right? See that action sense there? I think that's what this centurion is saying to Jesus. He says, you know, you've got authority. And again, I think it's an analogy. The centurion says, you know, look at even in the world, that kind of stuff goes on. You know, I command one of my soldiers, you know, jump, and they say, how high kind of stuff. Well, you know, it happens. And certainly, if that's the case for me, Jesus, that would be your authority, right? Your word, when you say it, is action. And at that point, I think when we look at that all as kind of hierarchy and coercion and all of that, that signifies already the way in which we want to twist and misunderstand what authority genuinely is, or at least the kind of authority that Jesus is talking about when he says, all authority is given to me. I don't know. You may want to disagree with Paul on that.
Let's go.
Well, that presents some textual problems then, doesn't it? In the Gospel of Matthew.
How so?
There isn't another ruler of the world in Matthew, like there is in John. You can't blame the other ruler.
That's right.
So if he has all authority, then why aren't there more than 11?
There are more than 11.
Some. Not all.
I'm not quite sure I understand.
Well, I mean,
some, not all.
You know, why does everything go so awry if he has all authority and if he can merely speak and that there is light in the darkness? I mean, for me, there's an enormous textual problem then. I mean, it's a parody, perhaps, of, okay, he's got this, but this is what the world actually responds, how the world responds to it. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how you answer the textual problem.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I think there that the understanding about that notion of authority, and that comes in what goes with that, and part of that is, I'll just put it here. The notion of obedience. To say that again, the authoritative word is spoken, heard. Obedience, again, we get this from the Latin root, ab audire, right? To listen toward or listen to. And the sense here, again, of disobedience, right, is not listening, right? And so the sense of what happens, why is Jesus' authority, why is God's authority not always carried out or followed through? Matthew's way of talking about that is because of obedience, which is, again, listening to or what. It's one of his ways of talking about faith. Disobedience, not listening, is unfaith or sin. And so I think from Matthew's perspective, that sense of if Jesus has all authority, then why is that not always carried through? Because we don't always listen.
So that describes the scribes and Pharisees. That describes the governor and his soldiers.
Yes, for
okay.
Matthew.
Okay.
For Matthew, it does. And in fact, we'll see this coming through in this little section that we'll get to in just a second. But for Matthew, that's right. The root problem is that sense of obedience or disobedience. And again, it's not obedience in the notion of a kind of dominating and controlling, you know, like if you don't listen to me, I'll have to, you know, whip you or something like that. But it has to do with that sense of truly hearing. Because when you hear, truly hear, listen, that means there is also understanding and action that follows accordingly.
And is there any blame involved in the gospel writer's message then for those that don't hear? Because, you know, for instance, right after the, right after 8:9, you know, he talks about the great faith mm-hmm. that the person has
mm-hmm.
because they heard something.
Mm-hmm.
And is there any blame that you know of in Matthew's gospel for those that don't hear?
Well, there are. There is the sense of, at times, the disciples are called little-faithed ones. And so in that sense, I'm not sure if it's there is the judgment, if you will, that you're not listening, but there's also that sense of forgiveness as well, like I said here, right? In this sense, you could say the disciples in the Garden of Gethsemane were not listening because they all took off, even though Jesus had told them at least 3 times in terms of passion prediction what will happen. They weren't listening, and you could say, all right, so now in Matthew 28, Jesus could come up to them and say, you guys need to listen better. But he didn't, right? There was instead, as I would suggest, that word of forgiveness, and then again, these words of authority and teaching. But there are other places where, yes, Jesus is, I would say, critical or judgmental of the disciples, saying, you little-faithed ones, or again, why did you doubt? One of the examples there is after the feeding of the 5,000, disciples are crossing the Sea of Galilee, the storm. Jesus comes walking to them on the water. They're not sure. Peter says, well, Jesus, if it's you, call me out, you know, summon me out to you. He says, okay, Peter, come on out. Right, kind of the price is right. Come on down. So he's out there walking on the water, and then he sees the waves and the storm, and whoa, and plunk, right, sinks. And Jesus says to him, you know, why did you doubt, you of little faith? Now, is that blame, criticism, judgment? I think that would be, you know, Matthew's way of looking at that. Yes, please.
Yeah, I thought of Matthew 7:26. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now there's that connection about hearing and doing.
Right. That's an obedience, if you will, is always both of those. It's always the hearing and the doing go together. Because if you truly hear, you do. If you truly understand, it enables action. Right? Simple example. I tell Renita, would you please open the door? Well, you know, if she understands, she'd open the door. Or if she understands, it's just an example and I didn't really mean it, she would still just sit there devotedly listening to my authoritative words.
So there's a spectrum. I mean, Peter is in the spectrum of not being disobedient, but he's on the pathway of learning how to be obedient.
Right.
And the 11 however you interpret doubt at the end, the 11 are in the pathway of becoming obedient, as opposed to the governor and the soldiers.
And pathway is a good, because again, you know, Matthew, again, a key theme for Matthew is follow me. And so that's always, you know, are we on that same path following Jesus, or are we, you know, not listening to that word and getting off the trail? To use a Holden hiking metaphor. Right. But yeah, that's right. That sense of obedience is that notion of a pathway.
It's quite to me that your question earlier is saying what the disciples do when it said they took off. Yet that they were basically forgiven. I mean, this wasn't, you know, I mean, in spite of all his teaching, they still didn't have a clue as to who he was. It was constant failure throughout the whole 3 years of ministry. And right down to the last, Peter's denial, everything else, but he still accepts them here after the resurrection and sends them out with a message. Hopefully that message will go out and do something, but we're all going to fail along the way. And I don't think that there's a gift and punishment situation here. I think it's a case of accepting it, doing the best you can, but you're going to fall every day.
Yeah, that's right. They, you know, those who had followed him, they should have known better. Right? Paul in Romans will up the ante on it, right? While we were yet sinners, Christ died for the ungodly. I mean, in some senses here, Matthew isn't quite willing to call the disciples the ungodly. I think he could say, if you will, Christ died for the really stupid ones who didn't get it. But, you know, it's the good news is even better than that. Christ dies for the ungodly. But if you see, again, you see that's all of a piece, and you see at that point then just how radical and central forgiveness is to all of this in terms of, you know, why were they so stupid? And then, of course, that becomes a reflexive question that you ask yourself, why am I so stupid?
Yeah,
and we're back to that worshiping, doubting.
Yeah. In answer to his question, if you haven't gotten the word, I mean, here they're sent out, it doesn't mean that you're not going to be saved. I still think God or Christ will somehow reach those people in another way. It's, you know, for us, it's him. Mm-hmm. But for others, there's other contacts and other things going and that says that they can be saved or whatever. They're not thrown aside if they don't know about it. But it's important to go out and tell them about it.
Yeah. Okay, this is, I just want, this is all your fault. Because this is a tangent, but I think might be important. I think it's Matthew chapter 11, verses 25 to 28. If you would turn to that, please. Maybe I should turn to it first and make sure that this is what I want. Just to 26, Matthew chapter 11, verses 25 to 27, please. If someone would read that.
At the time, Jesus said, I thank you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because you have hidden these things from the wise and the intelligent and have revealed them to infants. Yes, Father, for such was your gracious will. All things have been handed over to me by my Father, and no one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son chooses to reveal them.
Right. So I mean that all things have been handed over, all authority is given to me. But note there verses 25 and 26. It's almost, if you will, kind of to shock you, a thanksgiving for failure. I thank you, God. They're not getting it. Is that what's happening? What's happening there in those verses? Since that's, I mean, we're kind of talking about that, so it might be good.
It sounds a lot like predestination, doesn't it? A formula for that the Son chooses, accept the Son, and anyone to whom the Son chooses to reveal him. Mm-hmm. Is that blatant in Greek?
The word choose. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then is there anyone whom the Son has not chosen to reveal God? God has not chosen?
Well, just right. In the Gospel of Matthew, I mean, we're talking about all kinds of people that are always opposed and over and against.
Doesn't this say,
at this time,
doesn't this repeat somewhere in there, if we have the faith of a child, that's how and when we receive the gifts, I believe. They're hidden from the wise and the intelligent.
Seems like it's also giving a certain amount of, I guess I've always thought of authority, there's a certain amount of responsibility that goes with authority, that if you use it poorly, mm-hmm. that authority poorly, and this is, there's a lot of responsibility being put on the Son in this case to make those decisions.
Mm-hmm. Well, Matthew doesn't use the word predestined for Judas.
No.
That's another gospel. I mean,
that's John.
Yeah, that would really do me in if that was in Matthew.
Yeah. No.
I mean, because then I just begin to anger up against this God that predestined something. But,
well, I'm with you. I think the whole thing sounds like that. There's someone up there deciding what will happen. And why send out missionaries?
Well, if you're Calvinist, you send them out to find the ones that are pre-chosen, but because they don't know that they're chosen yet. But Lutherans are thinking differently about this.
Yeah. No, we're not talking about double predestination here, but we are talking about authority. I mean, to think that through in terms of this passage, who's in charge?
Jesus.
And Jesus chooses the cross in half.
And, hmm?
Jesus chooses the cross.
Yes, that's right.
As a way for me to reveal who he is.
Yeah.
It's not the messianic secret of Mark.
No.
So that brings it around for me that it's, you know, there's grace.
Right.
And that's what I'd have to do if I were preaching on.
But there's also,
which I have chosen to never do. I also have choice.
If we link this up to the notion of authority, I mean, it is saying here, who's in charge? And we say, Jesus is in charge. God's is in charge. Right? That, again, becomes really problematic because, you know, we'll personalize it. Basically, when it comes to our lives, when you ask who's in charge, you go, I am. I'm in charge of my life. I'm in control. And I think the passage here is saying, well, as soon as you think that, right, you who are so wise and intelligent to think that you're in charge of your life, well, all this stuff is going to be hidden from you. Because if you will, first and foremost, I want you to know you're not in charge. Right? Now, don't go, you know, you don't have to go predestination here. Just think about how that is indeed true. You're not in charge. Great teacher of mine, the University of Chicago, Paul Ricoeur, has a little phrase. I think it's absolutely true. We are not the authors of our lives. We are the narrators. Right. I can narrate my life. I can tell you my story, but I really can't create my life. Because by and large, most of the stuff that will comprise my life and your life is what happens to you. Right? Most of the time, we go through life, if you will, passive or receptive. Things happen to us. As Paul said last night in his little reflection, he came up here to Holden almost 2 years ago to figure out what he's going to do. He still hasn't done that. What happened, Paul? Well, probably you found out, oh man, I'm not in charge. Because whatever you thought was going to happen for 2 years up here, probably most of it never happened. And you lost, right? I mean, that's always what I ask myself, and especially in the parish. All right, now, exactly where was it when I lost control? Does that ever happen to you, Larry? Exactly when did you lose control of this service or of this meeting or whatever? And the other thing is, most of the time when you lose control, that's exactly when good things start to happen, right? When ministry takes place. Because what? I'm not in charge anymore, right? That's, so that here again, Jesus is saying, and why does he compare it to the infants? It's not even saying you have to have faith like a child, but again, right, infants are certainly never in charge. They're not in control. Well, they are sometimes, right? I mean, they cry and they get what they want. But in some respects, you can say infants aren't going to say, well, I'm going to control my life and hear it. They're very dependent on others. Same here, I think, that sense of authority and what we as disciples, first and foremost, need to understand is we're not in charge. We're not in control of our own life. God is the author of life, and that means my life, you know, not just kind of the generic Genesis one, oh yeah, the whole creation stuff, right? I mean, it's in terms of my life, this community, the church, the world, the cosmos, yes. But in that sense, what we do is we narrate, we tell the story of what now happens to us, and how God is present and at work in us. And I think that's part of what chapter 11 is about. I've written this down in the margins just simply because it's a phrase, again, one of Luther's little witty sayings. He says, quote unquote, "Those who think they have God by the toe have the devil by the fist." Right. Only right, typical Luther stuff, right? Those who think they have God by the toe, right, kind of you grab and can control God, have the devil by the fist. Right. Because it's a sense of that disobedience of thinking that you have the authority. So, again, what's going on here in this, at times, hard passage, I think, to understand and interpret is, again, Jesus' sayings there. It's not, again, a thanksgiving for failure, but indeed, if you will, a thanksgiving for faith that helps us understand who is in charge, who has the authority, and our relationship to that kind of authority. So that's what. See, so this is all your fault. Look at where you've taken us. Right? Anyway, that sense of authority. One more notion of authority. I'm going to skip 9, 6, and 10, 1, and go to this because of our time. If someone please would read Matthew chapter 21, 23 to 27. And this is, again, the contrast between Jesus and the scribes.
When he entered the temple, the chief priests and the elders of the people came to him as he was teaching and said, "By what authority are you doing these things? And who gave you this authority?" Jesus said to them, "I will also ask you one question. If you tell me the answer, then I will also tell you by what authority I do these things. Did the baptism of John come from heaven, or was it of human origin?" And they argued with one another. "If we say from heaven, he will say to us, why then did you not believe him? But if we say of human origin, we are afraid of the crowd, for all regard John as a prophet. So they answered Jesus, we do not know. And he said to them, neither will I tell you by the authority I am doing these things.
Okay. What does that tell us about authority?
He's speaking to the most disobedient, if that's the model, the most disobedient people to his authority, in one of the most authoritarian hierarchical places of the world, ancient world.
I would think this would be difficult for those of you that are clergy, like Larry and all of you, because how do you, those of us sitting in the church, think of you as the authority? What do you do with that?
Milk it for all it's worth.
Oh, no.
Run away screaming.
That doesn't help.
Oh, Marilyn, why do you ask the tough questions? Oh, let's ask those other authorities. I mean, what do you do with that, Renita? Sarah, you're in this mess too. What do you do with that sense?
Well, we're not supposed to have authority because you're, when you do the absolution, you say, and by his authority. Mm-hmm. So it's not, I think it's misplaced. And after 10 years in campus ministry, where you learn to die all the every day, I guess I've just learned to give power away, and then it comes back to you, you give it away, and it comes back to you, you give it away. But
so we really shouldn't believe everything you say. I mean, we really don't believe everything you say.
The authority, the authority is in the office, and the office authority is in the word. So unless Christ is proclaimed and preached, which sets people free from their sin, there is no real authority.
We skipped 10:1, but Jesus summoned his disciples and gave them authority. So authority is not necessarily a bad thing.
No.
To a certain extent, as a pastor, you have to be able to lead. And sometimes leading takes a certain amount of authority. Now it's servant authority. And it's not something that you wave over people. But it's, I think, if it is authority, it comes from trust and love of the person who they've commissioned to be their pastor, they've called to be their pastor.
Well, what a responsibility then.
Yeah, and I think that's much more accurate in terms of the responsibility. I mean, in that sense, as Larry said, in that sense, the key thing within that passage is how for us as disciples, and that goes for all of us, not just clergy, right? I mean, again, that's kind of that misunderstand that usually when we hear the word authority, because that's how it usually works out there, right away we're into hierarchies. And hierarchies have worked their way into the church too. I mean, there's no mistake about that. But this sense of authority, I mean, again, the kind of paradoxical thing, Matthew is so big on authority, but Matthew has no hierarchy. Because again, authority is bestowed. And I would say that within the pastoral office, it's the sense, remember, it is a congregation, a community that calls, if you will, it gives that one authority. It's not that I come in and say, oh, I'm the pastor, I've got authority, listen up. But it's rather, we have called you to be our pastor, to make sure the gospel happens among us. And we want you to do that. That we give you that authority, and as pastor then, I am responsible, I am accountable for making sure that the gospel does happen among that community that's called me. I mean, I think that's the way I would look at that sense of authority. And for me then, it's much more a notion of responsibility.
Maybe I like to say something just too. It's just a story. It's a gift when people call me pastor. And sometimes when I walk outside of that community that has called me to be their pastor, people will call me pastor. And my responses often are, they say, well, what should I call you, Ellen? Should I, you know, how do I? And I say, I'm called to a specific community as their pastor. You may call me Ellen. Now, other clergy really disagree with that. But for me, it isn't that I'm pastor in those other settings. I'm a disciple like everybody else. I'm a pastor at Peace Lutheran. I'm their pastor. It's also a relationship word with the people I serve, which isn't the way other clergy answer that some days.
Well, I was just going to say, Jesus' authority is as being author in and with God.
Right.
And that authority is whether anybody follows it or not. So that one, that's not authority that's given. That's authority that's offered.
Yeah.
Although again, in this passage of in the end of Matthew, right, Jesus says, all authority has been given to me, so that he recognizes that even there, his authority is that given to him by God. Right, but again, that's a very close relationship.
But I think in your use of the example where, as a pastor, you had some training and credentials before you took on this job of leading a congregation. And you got some authority based upon at least some education. Here, Jesus is talking to the scribes and the Pharisees, which are really purchased positions in many cases.
Which are really what?
Purchased.
Some of them, but I mean, there's others that have had lots of education as well.
But I mean, it's the kind of a thing where thereafter, he's hired in this process, and they've turned everything into a business venture, which was violating even his feelings about the temple. And challenging his authority against somebody whose authority in many cases was to Rome, or at least bowing to Rome in the process and not doing anything to upset the apple cart. They were out to get him, and he knew this.
Sure. Yeah. One more comment. We've got to stop here. But one more comment about that. I mean, what is, in terms of the scribes and the leaders' response to that, what was one of the reasons, you know, they can't, why don't they want to answer Jesus' question?
Well, because they're going to be trying to answer the crowds in the process.
Right, I mean, again, that notion, and if you will, kind of much more our typical notion of authority, very much the political way of authority today, you know, I mean, again, what's President Bush going to do next? Well, I don't know. We'll send out a poll and see if my popularity goes up. I'll vote for putting National Guard on the border. And if my popularity goes down, then we won't do that. Right? I mean, right? That's not authority. Right? That's popularity. That might be the way you are able to keep power. But that's not authority. And so, again, here, you can see the passage and the criticism that Jesus levels against these folks, whether they're educated or not, bought their office or not, whatever else is in there. You see, authority has nothing to do with, you know, popular vote, opinion, will they like you, won't they like you, or all of those notions that we nowadays, back then as well, often would use to try to get authority for ourselves. So again, it's a tremendous criticism and critique of our usual ways of understanding authority.
Well, excuse me.
If they didn't look to the crowd, if they didn't hear what people think, but looked instead to what God thinks, they would also know who Jesus is. Right? So then he exposes them for who they are. And doesn't have to answer the question somewhat.
That's right. He doesn't have to answer the question because he's answered the question.
Yeah, he's
that's
yeah.
right.
And he's also turned the tables, and so he's not living under their authority either.
Right.
Ever since this gospel was written, it's been interpreted in 1,000 different ways of how to use authority in the word of Christ. You know, and somebody in this room, it comes from a congregation that's split by the pastor's authority. And that will always be the case, huh? I mean, that's the interesting kind of conundrum to Matthew, is how do you ever use this correctly? Luther has some advisement about that, but he comes out of a conflicted, convoluted problem in life.
Yeah, big problem there in the Reformation precisely was that question of authority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know.
Maybe that's the reality, though. It's always going to be that way.
For me, every gospel represents a different system of Christianity. And Matthew's got a system that I need to learn more and remember better and to watch and see what happens when you use that system. There's reasons, I think, why we all like different gospels, but how we use authority, perhaps, is one of the key issues for Matthew's gospel mm-hmm. in the church.
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
But all these pastors that I know that are mostly evangelical that have gotten in trouble by leading the people through the Matthean process that are, so to speak, to be disciplined as members, you know, they don't use John or Mark or Luke. They use Matthew. And they all get in trouble and they get lawsuits. I think there was just one in the paper recently, again, somebody exposing the sins of one of the members publicly. You know, after they were brought forward and talked to privately and brought to the council, and they were disobedient. So we're going to expose their sin. I don't know.
Because then they won't look at ours.
We should stop here. Thank you all very much. Good discussion. Good sense of it.